the storm arrived, before she did. It came rolling in from the north, heavy and cold, dragging curtains of rain across the moors like a hand sweeping a table clean. By the time the hired carriage turned onto the long gravel drive of Silver Oak Hall, the sky had turned the color of old iron, and the oak trees lining the path bent low, their branches clawing the air. Inside the carriage, Louisa Sterling pressed her gloved fingers together in her lap and watched the great house rise through the rain-blurred window. Silver Oak Hall. She had heard of it, of course. Everyone had. 12,000 acres of estate, a house with 47 rooms, a staff of 60, and a duke who had not smiled, truly smiled, since the death of his wife, 5 years past. The house was old stone and older pride, its towers cutting into the gray sky like a warning. Even through the downpour, even from a distance, Louisa could feel the cold of the place. It was the kind of cold that did not come from temperature alone. She exhaled, slowly. Her dress was 3 years old. Her boots were mended at the heel, the leather soft now where it had been rubbed to near nothing. Her single trunk contained 2 evening gowns, 4 day dresses, and every remaining piece of dignity she owned. She was the daughter of the late Earl Stirling. She had once danced at the Ashmore Ball with a princess of the realm in the same room. She had once had a dowry, a future, a name that opened doors. Now, she was arriving through the servant's entrance. The carriage stopped. The footman did not help her down. He had not spoken to her since she'd shown him the letter of employment. She descended herself, her boots landing in a puddle, mud splashing the hem of her skirt. She did not flinch. She walked to the side entrance, lifted the iron knocker, and knocked. Inside, the housekeeper, Mrs. Prentice, a stiff-backed woman of 60 with kind eyes, and she worked hard to hide, led Louisa through a corridor that smelled of beeswax and old wood. Their footsteps were absorbed by thick rugs. The candles in the sconces were already lit, though it was only 4 in the afternoon. The storm had eaten the daylight whole. His Grace will see you in the study, Mrs. Prentice said, without looking back. You will stand when spoken to. You will not offer opinions unless they are asked for. You will not raise your voice in any room he occupies. Louisa said nothing. Do you understand, Miss Sterling? Perfectly, Louisa said. Mrs. Prentice paused at a great mahogany door, gave Louisa a look that was both sympathetic and warning, then knocked twice. The voice that answered was low, controlled. The kind of voice that did not need volume to carry weight. Send her in. William Ashcroft, Duke of Ravenscar, did not stand when Louisa entered. He sat behind an enormous mahogany desk, the kind of desk that had been in this room longer than anyone living had been alive, with his hands folded on top of an open file. He was younger than she had expected. 34, perhaps 35, with the kind of face that had once been warm and was now simply severe. His jaw was set. His eyes were grey, the color of the storm outside. And when they lifted to find her face, they were assessing with the detachment of a man who had learned long ago to keep emotion locked, somewhere deep and unreachable. He was, Louisa thought against her better judgment, devastatingly handsome. She shut that thought away immediately. Miss Sterling. He did not gesture to a chair. You have traveled from Ipswich.
I have, Your Grace.
In a hired carriage.
Yes.
He glanced down at the file. Your father's estate, Haverfield Park, was sold to settle debts in March of last year. The sum recovered covered less than half of what was owed. He turned a page. Your father borrowed heavily against the estate in his final years. Wool investments, a shipping venture that failed. He turned another page. There are, at present, outstanding debts attached to your family name totaling a figure I will not embarrass you by reading aloud. Louisa stood very still. Her hands, folded in front of her, did not tremble. She had rehearsed this, rehearsed the stillness, rehearsed keeping her chin level. She had known he would have the file. Men like him always had the file. You have worked as a companion to Lady Hargreave of Norfolk, the Duke continued, for a period of 8 months before the position was terminated. Lady Hargreave and I had a disagreement about the care of her grandchildren, Louisa said, her voice even. She wished them kept quiet and indoors. I did not. His eyes lifted again.
Something shifted in them, barely perceptible, like a door opening 1 inch before being shut. "And before that," he said, "you had 2 further positions, neither lasting longer than 4 months. I am told I have a tendency to overstep." "You are told correctly." He closed the file. 4 governesses have attempted to manage my daughter in the past 14 months. None lasted longer than 6 weeks. Lady Violet is. He paused. The pause was long enough to mean something. Difficult. "May I speak candidly, Your Grace?" The question seemed to surprise him. Or perhaps it was the directness of it, the absence of a deferential pause before she asked. "You may," he said. Louisa met his gaze. "With respect, Your Grace. I did not travel through a storm on borrowed money to hear about my failures. I know what they are. What I need to know is whether you are willing to employ someone who will not simply manage your daughter, but genuinely help her." She kept her voice steady. "4 governesses have failed, Your Grace. Not because your daughter is difficult, but because no one has tried to understand her." A breath. "That is what I will do, if you allow it." The room was very quiet. Rain struck the leaded windows behind his desk in long, sliding lines. William Ashcroft looked at Louisa Sterling for a long moment. "And why," he said, very quietly, "should I employ you?" Louisa did not blink. "Because your daughter needs someone who loves her more than her father's pride." The silence that followed was the kind that filled a room entirely, pressing into the corners, thinning the air. The Duke said nothing. He looked at her, really looked at her, for the first time since she had entered the room, the way a man looks at something that has startled him without permission. Then he said, "You will begin tomorrow. Mrs. Prentice will show you to your room." Louisa curtsied, turned, and walked to the door with the measured steps of a woman who was shaking only on the inside. Her room was on the 3rd floor. In the east wing, decent quarters for a governess, she supposed, though the window overlooked the kitchen garden and the fire had not been lit. She lit it herself, changed out of her wet dress, and stood for a long moment before the narrow mirror above the dressing table. She was 26. She had brown hair that would not quite stay pinned, and eyes the color of amber glass when the light caught them. She was not the kind of beautiful that stopped rooms. She was the kind of beautiful that crept up on people slowly, like warmth from a fire you hadn't noticed until you moved away from it. She pressed her palms flat against the dressing table and drew a slow breath. She had gotten the position. Now she had to keep it. She met Lady Violet the following morning. The child was 7 years old and sat at a table in the schoolroom with the posture of a small queen and the expression of someone who had already decided this meeting was a waste of time. She had her father's gray eyes and her mother's from the portrait Louisa had glimpsed in the corridor, dark, curling hair, and she sat with her hands folded precisely in her lap. 3 books were stacked on the table, all unopened. A doll sat on the shelf behind her, also untouched. "You are the new governess," Violet said. "I am." "You will leave within a month." Louisa pulled out the chair across from her and sat down, which was apparently not what previous governesses had done, because Violet blinked. "Why do you think so?" Louisa asked. "Because they all do." The child's voice was very small and very precise. "Governess Hartley left after 3 weeks. She said I was unmanageable. Governess Price left after 5 weeks. She cried a great deal." A pause. "I don't like it when people cry." "Neither do I," Louisa said honestly. Violet studied her. "You are not setting out the lesson books." "Not yet." Louisa leaned forward slightly, resting her forearms on the table. "I thought first we might talk. What do you like, Lady Violet?" "Not what you are supposed to like. What you actually like." The question seemed to bewilder the child. It took a full 10 seconds before she answered. "Horses," Violet said finally. "And the garden in the spring. When the bluebells come, and stories about knights. But only the ones where someone clever solves the problem instead of just fighting." A pause, as if she'd said too much. "And drawing. But I am told I draw too much." "Told by whom?" Violet's eyes slid to the window, toward the east wing, where her father's study sat behind its enormous mahogany door. She didn't answer. Louisa picked up the first lesson book, set it aside, and drew a blank piece of paper from the stack on the shelf. "Tell me about the bluebells," she said. "And while you talk, you may draw." For the first time, something in Violet's expression shifted. Not a smile. Not yet. But the door had opened, just slightly, and warmth was beginning to find the crack. In the corridor outside the schoolroom, behind the half-closed door, a shadow moved. William Ashcroft stood very still, listening. He had come to check, he told himself. That was all it was, to check that the new governess was applying appropriate structure, appropriate discipline. Instead, he heard his daughter talking. Not the flat, polite sentences she offered adults. Talking the way children talked when they forgot to be careful. He listened for a moment longer than he should have. Then he turned and walked back toward his study without making a sound. That evening, the Dowager Duchess arrived. Lady Beatrice Ashcroft, William's mother, came without warning, which was the only way she ever came anywhere. She was 61 years old, sharp as a letter knife, and she moved through Silver Oak Hall as though she owned it, which, she never failed to remind William, she very nearly had. She swept into the drawing room where William sat with papers, dropped herself into the armchair across from him with an audible sigh of satisfaction, and said, "I hear you've hired a new governess." "I hire staff regularly, Mother. It is not a notable event. This one told you that Violet needs someone who loves her more than your pride." Beatrice's eyes shone. "I like her already." William did not look up from his papers. "Mrs. Prentice speaks too freely. Mrs. Prentice loves this household and watches over it like a hen. Don't be cross with her." A pause. "I intend to have dinner with Miss Sterling tomorrow. I want to know what kind of woman survives your interview and still walks out with her chin up. She is employed to educate my daughter, not to befriend you." "Darling," Beatrice said cheerfully, "everyone befriends me eventually. It is my greatest curse." She reached for the teapot on the side table, poured herself a cup without being invited to, and settled back. "How was she?" "The interview." The longest pause. "Adequate," William said. Beatrice smiled into her teacup. "Hey, quick question. How are you feeling right now?" "Thank you so much for being here. It really means the world to me. I'm working toward 10,000 subscribers. And if Louisa's story is already pulling at your heart, please hit that subscribe button for this channel. Smash the like. And drop a comment telling me where you're watching from. It helps more than you know." "All right. Thank you. Now let's get back to what happens when the woman he said he could replace by dawn becomes the one he never recovered from." 3 weeks passed. In that time, something changed inside Silver Oak Hall. It was not a dramatic change, not the kind you could point to and name. It was more like the difference in a room when someone has opened a window that has been sealed too long. The air was different. Something moved through the corridors that had not moved there in years. Louisa did not follow the lesson plan that had been laid out for her. She set it aside on the third day, politely but entirely, and replaced it with something that looked more like an adventure. She taught Latin through stories of Roman soldiers and mythological creatures. She taught arithmetic through the measuring of flower beds in the kitchen garden. She taught history by acting it out, she and Violet both, with Louisa taking the part of the villain whenever there was one, which Violet found endlessly amusing. She read to the child every evening before bed. Not dry. Improving texts. Stories. Ones with dragons and clever girls and horses that spoke. By the end of the second week, Violet was waiting at the schoolroom door each morning when Louisa arrived. By the end of the third week, something happened that Mrs. Prentice, who had served the Duke's household for 22 years, would later say she would remember until she died. Violet laughed. It came from the schoolroom. Unexpected and bright as a struck match in a dark room. A real laugh, a child's laugh, full and unguarded, the kind that spills out before you can think to stop it. Louisa had been doing a voice for one of the Roman generals, giving him an absurd accent she'd invented entirely, and Violet had looked up from her notebook and simply dissolved into laughter. In the corridor below, the kitchen maid stopped walking. The footman, carrying a tray, paused at the foot of the stairs. Mrs. Prentice, coming around the corner from the linen room, stopped so abruptly that she had to press her hand against the wall, and her eyes filled. She turned and walked quickly back toward the kitchen, before anyone could see, pressing the back of her hand to her mouth, composing herself the way people compose themselves when something has surprised them with joy. William heard it from the east wing. He had been reading a report from his land agent, or trying to, though he had read the same paragraph 4 times without absorbing it. When the sound came through the walls, faint, high, real, he set the paper down. He sat for a long moment with his hands flat on the desk. Then, slowly, he rose and walked to the window that overlooked the garden, as though the sound had come from outside, as though he needed to locate it precisely, as though he did not already know exactly what it was. He had not heard his daughter laugh like that since before Eleanor died. The knowledge settled in his chest like a coal, warm and aching at once. He told himself it was simply evidence that the new governess was competent. He told himself he would note it in her employment file, as a positive mark. He told himself it meant nothing beyond the professional satisfaction of a well-functioning household. He stood at the window for longer than he should have, watching rain begin to fall over the garden again, feeling something he could not name pressing at the inside of his ribs, asking to be let out. He did not let it. He went back to his desk. He picked up the report. He did not read it. He began watching her. Not openly, William Ashcroft was not a man who did anything openly that he had not decided to do, but he found himself noting her patterns. The hour she walked with Violet in the garden, the corner of the library she preferred in the evenings, where she sat curled in the red velvet chair with a book held close to the lamplight. The way she spoke to the servants, not with the automatic authority of the aristocrat she had once been, nor with the careful deference of the employee she was now, but like a person. Like someone who had decided that a person was a person regardless of what they were wearing or who they worked for. He watched her make Violet bold. He watched Violet begin asking questions at dinner, instead of sitting silent and correct. He watched the child draw pictures and leave them in unexpected places around the house on the hall table, on the windowsill of the morning room, small pencil drawings of horses and knights, and one very recognizable drawing of a woman with hair that wouldn't stay pinned. He watched his house become something it had not been in 5 years. He told himself he was observing the effects of competent management. He told himself many things. He did not examine them too closely. "You're watching her," Beatrice said, appearing beside him one afternoon, as he stood in the gallery, overlooking the library below. "You have been watching her for the better part of 20 minutes. William did not move from the railing. "I am reviewing the household schedule. With your eyes." She folded her arms and looked down at the library, where Louisa sat reading, firelight spreading amber warmth across her hair. "William, I have known you for 34 years. I know the face you make when you are reviewing a schedule. This is not that face." "Mother, she is extraordinary," Beatrice said, in a voice that had lost its usual lightness. "You know that. Violet has changed. This house has changed. The servants sing, 'William, do you know that Mrs. Prentice has taken to humming? That woman has not hummed since the reign of the previous king.'" A pause. "It is the effect of a person who genuinely loves where she is and what she does." William said nothing. "She had nothing when she came here," Beatrice said quietly. "And she has rebuilt herself on character alone. I find that remarkable." William pushed off from the railing. "She is the governess," he said. "It would be inappropriate to find anything about her." He walked away. Beatrice watched him go, her expression somewhere between fond and mournful. "You have always been the most exhausting man," she said softly, "to no one at all." It was raining again the day Louisa found the garden. She had been walking the long way from the schoolroom to the house, taking a path she hadn't tried before, when the wall of box hedges opened onto a space that made her stop walking entirely. It was a walled garden, tucked against the south face of the hall, hidden from view of the main house. Someone had built it, with carestone paths, winding between beds that had once been full of roses. She could see the bones of it, even now. The iron trellises rusted at the joints, the rose stems still growing despite years of neglect, reaching along the walls like hands, finding their way in the dark. A stone bench sat at the center, mossy and damp. A sundial stood beside it, tilted slightly, its face unreadable. It had once been beautiful. It had not been tended in a very long time. Louisa stood in the entrance and breathed in the smell of wet stone and old growth, and felt, without quite knowing why, that she was standing somewhere private, somewhere that belonged to someone's grief. You should not be in here. She turned. William Ashcroft stood at the gap in the hedge, his coat dark with rain, his expression, which was nearly always unreadable, carrying something now that she recognized. Not anger. Something rawer than anger. Something that had not found its language yet. Forgive me, Louisa said quietly. I did not know it was closed to the household. It is not closed. He stepped into the garden. His eyes moved over it slowly, the way eyes move over something painful that they cannot stop looking at. It simply isn't used. A silence. The rain fell steadily around them. It was Eleanor's garden, he said. The name was quiet, controlled. The control was almost perfect. Almost. She designed it herself. Every bed, every path. His jaw tightened. After she died, I had it sealed. The servants do not come here. Louisa looked at the rose stems, climbing the rusted trellises. She thought of the amount of grief that went into sealing a garden, into locking away everything that had been warm. The roses are still growing, she said. He looked at her. They kept going, she said carefully. Even without anyone tending them. They are still growing. She paused. There is something in that, perhaps. The silence stretched between them, rain-filled and careful. And then William Ashcroft looked at Louisa Sterling with something in his eyes she had not yet seen there. Not the cold assessment of the interview, not the remote courtesy of the first weeks, but something unguarded. Something that had not meant to appear. He looked away almost immediately. Come away from the rain, he said, his voice reclaimed, controlled again. You will catch cold. They walked back to the house without speaking. But the silence was different from the silence that usually existed between them. It had texture now. It had shared something in it, like two people who had looked at the same wound, and neither had flinched. Over the days that followed, William began engineering reasons to speak with her. He would not have called them that, of course. He called them reviewing Violet's progress, checking on the weekly lesson schedule, discussing the estate library's educational texts. But he kept her standing in doorways longer than the topic required. He asked questions with longer answers than he needed. He was, for the first time in 5 years, genuinely listening to another person speak, and not because he had to. Louisa knew. She could not help but know. A woman always knows when a man's eyes find her more than once in a room, when his steps slow near where she is standing, when his voice loses a degree of its formality, just slightly, just enough. She told herself to be careful. She was employed here. She was dependent on this position. She could not afford the luxury of feeling things that could cost her everything. She told herself this every morning. She believed it a little less each day. The morning of the harvest fair in the village was clear and bright, the storm system finally broken, and Violet had asked every person in the household with increasing urgency whether she might attend. In the end, it was Louisa who made it possible simply by telling William, over the week's schedule review, that the educational value of seeing the agricultural traditions of his own estate could not be overstated. She said it with such professional composure that he had almost not noticed she was arguing for the child. He noticed. He had arranged a carriage. He had also, without quite meaning to arrange, to accompany them himself. He spent most of the fair walk slightly behind Louisa, watching her show Violet the prize-winning vegetables with the same enthusiasm she might have shown a royal gallery. She had a gift for making things magnificent. She pointed out the patterns in the cabbages as though they were cathedral windows. She talked to the old farmer who had been winning the turnip competition for 30 years, with the gravity of someone being granted an audience with a distinguished scholar. Violet was entranced. William was not looking at Violet. On the way home, the carriage hit a rut in the road and rocked sharply. Louisa caught the side rail, lost her balance, and William's hand came to her arm, automatically steadying her, holding her, and neither of them pulled away quite as quickly as they should have. In the small, enclosed space of the carriage, with Violet asleep against Louisa's other side, with the late afternoon light making gold bars across the seat between them, they sat 3 inches apart, in a silence that was not silence at all. "Thank you," Louisa said, meaning the fare, meaning Violet. "The child needed it," he said. She turned to look at him. He was already looking at her. The carriage moved through long autumn light. Neither of them spoke again until they reached Silver Oak Hall, and by then, something had changed between them, not dramatically, not visibly, but thoroughly, the way a river changes course, not in one dramatic moment, but inch by inch over years, until one day you look and realize it has gone somewhere entirely new. Violet noticed, as children always do, with a child's uncomplicated precision. She was sitting at her drawing table one morning when she said, without looking up, "Papa smiles when you are here, Miss Sterling." Louisa's pen stopped moving on the page. "I mean the real kind," Violet added thoughtfully. "Not the polite kind. The polite kind only goes to here." She drew a line across her own face with one finger, indicating the lower half. "The real kind goes all the way up." Louisa set her pen down carefully. "Your father is very pleased with your progress," she said. Her voice was admirably steady. Violet drew a horse. "I think he is pleased with you." Louisa looked at the child for a long moment. She thought about what to say. She said, "Shall we begin the Latin this morning or start with the arithmetic?" Violet smiled, the small, knowing smile of a child who had been cleverly redirected and knew it perfectly well. "Latin," she said. "The one with the Roman soldiers." Lady Charlotte Kensington arrived on a Tuesday afternoon in November, announced 3 days in advance, with a carriage, a lady's maid, 2 trunks, and the effortless authority of a woman who had never been told no in a way that lasted. She was 28, blonde, and beautiful, in the precise way that oil portraits tried to be perfectly symmetrical, utterly composed. She had grown up spending summers at Silver Oak Hall. Her mother had been Eleanor's closest friend. She had, as far as London society was concerned, a natural and obvious claim on the future of this estate and the man who ran it. She looked at Louisa once, on the first evening, across the length of the drawing room. It was not an unfriendly look. That was almost the worst part. It was a look that categorized quickly and quietly, that placed Louisa in a box, labeled it, and set it on the shelf, and then moved on. Charlotte sat beside William at dinner. She spoke beautifully about London, about mutual friends, about the upcoming winter season. She asked William questions that reminded him of shared history. She touched his sleeve twice, lightly, when she laughed. Louisa ate her dinner on the left side of the table, beside Beatrice, and said almost nothing. "She is performing very well," Beatrice murmured, under the cover of conversation. "Lady Charlotte is charming," Louisa said. Beatrice looked at her with those sharp, kind eyes. "I was not speaking of Charlotte." The whispers began within the week. A letter reached London. Louisa never knew who sent it, suggesting that the new governess at Silver Oak Hall was overstepping her position in ways that were improper, that she had been seen alone with the Duke, that her previous employers had not spoken well of her character, only her competence. Lady Charlotte herself said nothing directly. She was far too skilled for that. But she asked questions in a tone of gentle concern. Had Miss Sterling recovered well from her family's difficulties? Was it not admirable, really, that she was managing so well, given everything? Were the children of certain families really suited to become educators of children from others? The implication was delicate. It was also devastating. The servants heard. The local families heard. Invitations that might have been extended, small kindnesses that smoothed a governess's life, were not extended. Louisa did not tell anyone. She simply continued her work. She got up each morning, dressed, walked to the schoolroom, and poured everything she had into a small, gray-eyed girl who was learning to laugh again, William noticed. Not the whispers, he did not move in that social space. But he noticed the quality of stillness that came over Louisa in public rooms when Charlotte was present. The way she kept herself small and precise. The way her warmth which usually filled rooms freely, was carefully contained. One evening, he found her in the library, very late, alone. She was sitting in her usual chair, but the book was closed in her lap. The fire had burned low. She was staring at the grate with an expression he recognized, the expression of someone doing very hard arithmetic in their head and not yet arriving at the right answer. He should have left her to it. He did not. He came and sat in the chair across from her, something he had never done before. The lamp on the table between them threw warm light over both their faces. "You have been avoiding the drawing room in the evenings," he said. Louisa glanced up. "I thought it more appropriate to keep to the library." "Appropriate." He considered the word. Something sharp in his expression. "In this house, you have made my daughter laugh. You have made my staff feel valued. You have walked into an atmosphere of cold and made it warm, without asking for recognition or reward." His voice was deliberate. "You are not required to make yourself invisible, because Lady Charlotte requires more space." Louisa looked at him for a moment that stretched. "That is," she stopped, tried again. "Thank you, Your Grace." The firelight moved between them. Outside the tall windows, the November wind pressed against the glass. "William," he said. She looked up sharply. "In a room with no one present," he said. "I believe the formality is unnecessary." The silence between them was not empty. It was the fullest kind of silence, the kind that contains everything that cannot yet be said. "William," she said softly. It was only his name. It was only two syllables. She had not the faintest idea how much it cost her to say it so calmly. He did not smile. His expression held the careful restraint of a man standing at a great height, looking down. But his eyes, those gray, storm-colored eyes, did something she had never seen them do before. They warmed, just slightly, just enough, and then he rose, bid her good night in his usual composed way, and left. Louisa sat for a long time after, her book still closed, her hands very still, staring at the chair where he had been. She was in terrible, thorough, entirely predictable trouble. The almost kiss happened in the portrait gallery. She had gone there one afternoon to fetch Violet, who had taken to drawing the portraits. She rounded the corner at the end of the long gallery and found William standing before the portrait of Eleanor. He didn't hear her. He was simply looking at the portrait, not with the closed, sealed grief she might have expected, but with something more complicated, something that included guilt. "I am sorry," Louisa said softly. "I didn't mean to intrude." He turned. He was very close. The gallery was narrow, and she had come close without realizing. For a moment, neither of them moved. She could see the exact color of his eyes in the afternoon light. She could see the tension in his jaw, the controlled stillness of a man who was exerting a great deal of effort to stand still. She felt the warmth of him, close in the narrow space, and something pulled low and warm through her chest, through her whole self, a tide she had never felt so clearly. He lifted his hand. His fingers stopped just before they reached her face. Just before. He lowered his hand, took one step back. "Violet will be in the schoolroom," he said. His voice was perfectly level. It cost him considerably to make it so. He walked away. Louisa stood in the portrait gallery alone, one hand pressed flat against the wall, breathing. Fear, she thought. He was afraid. Not of her, of what she made him feel, of what it might mean to feel it. She understood that. She was afraid of exactly the same thing. The argument came in December. It had been building for weeks, not between Louisa and William, but around them, in the pressure that had been accumulating from every direction at once. The estate's winter accounts, a letter from London suggesting William was expected at a social engagement he had no desire to attend. Charlotte, who had extended her stay by 2 weeks without asking, circling the household with her gracious, devastating elegance. And something else. William had overheard Charlotte speaking to Violet in the corridor. He had not meant to hear, but he had. And what Charlotte had said not unkindly, not even with obvious intent, was that Lady Violet should be careful not to become too attached to those in service positions, as they had a tendency to move on. It was said with a smile. It was said gently. It landed like a blade. Violet had gone quiet for the rest of the day. When William found Louisa that evening and told her because he needed to tell someone, because the guilt of watching his daughter's small face go still was too heavy to carry alone. Louisa's expression did not change immediately, but her eyes did. Something moved through them. Grief. Then anger. Then a very deliberate composure. "She is not wrong," Louisa said carefully. "I am in service. Violet should not build her sense of security entirely around. She should have every security that this house can provide," William said, his voice sharper than he intended. "She has had enough taken from her." "Yes," Louisa said. "She has." A pause. "As have you." The silence had teeth. "You overstep," he said. The words came automatically from the part of him that reached for control when things became too close, too warm, too real. "Perhaps," Louisa said. "I have been told so before. You take liberties with the structure of this household. You invite familiarity with the staff. You alter lesson plans without consultation. You. I have made your daughter happy." Her voice was steady, but something in it had gone very still. "I have helped to heal this house. I do not think that was overstepping. You do not set the limits of your role." His voice had gone cold now, the coldness he used like a wall. "I do." Louisa looked at him. Her eyes held something he had not seen in them before. Not anger. Not quite. Disappointment. The specific kind of disappointment that comes from seeing someone clearly and understanding they are about to hurt you. "Then you should perhaps clarify those limits in the morning," she said quietly. "So that I know where I stand." "You stand where I place you. Cold. Deliberate. Wrong." Even as he said it, some part of him knew it was wrong, but the wall was up, and the man behind the wall had been frightened and was now retreating into the only language he had ever learned for self-protection. Mrs. Prentice was in the corridor. Charlotte had appeared at the top of the stairs. Violet was behind the schoolroom door, which was not entirely closed, and William Ashcroft, in front of all of them, said, "Positions of this nature are not irreplaceable, Miss Sterling. I can replace you by dawn." The room went very quiet, the kind of quiet that is not peaceful but shocked, the way a room goes quiet when something has broken that cannot be repaired. Louisa looked at him, not with tears, not with anger, with something much worse. A clear, direct, heartbroken recognition of exactly what had just been said, and why, and what it cost. She reached into the pocket of her dress and removed the small iron household key that Mrs. Prentice had given her on her first day, the symbol of her position in the hall. She set it on the side table. "Then do it," she said, and she walked away. Not quickly. Not dramatically. With the precise and terrible dignity of a woman who would not let them see how badly she was bleeding, the front door of Silver Oak Hall opened. The cold December air came in. The front door closed. William stood in the entrance hall and told himself she would return in the morning. She did not return in the morning. She did not return at all. Morning came to Silver Oak Hall, gray and silent. William sat at his desk by 6 o'clock. The papers before him were the same ones from the night before. He had not slept. The fire had gone out, and he had not noticed, and the cold in the study was now the same cold that had been in the house for 5 years before Louisa had come. He told himself she would send a message. She would reconsider. She was a practical woman. She understood the value of a secure position. He told himself many things. At 8 o'clock, Mrs. Prentice knocked and entered. "Her room has been vacated, Your Grace," she said. Her voice was flat. Not the professional flatness of a housekeeper managing information, but the flat voice of a woman who was holding herself together by sheer will. "She left before dawn. She took nothing that was not hers. She will have gone to the village inn," William said. "She will have nowhere else to go immediately. She was on the first mail coach to Ipswich, Your Grace. The driver confirmed it this morning." William said nothing. "Lady Violet is asking for her," Mrs. Prentice said. He still said nothing. Mrs. Prentice curtsied and left, and the silence in the study was absolute. "Violet asked for Louisa at breakfast," she asked calmly, in the precise way of a child who has learned that emotion is not always safe. "Where is Miss Sterling?" William sat across from her at the long table. The table was too big for two people. It had always been too big, but it had never felt as large as it did that morning. "Miss Sterling has ended her position with our household," he said. Violet looked at him. She had gray eyes, like his, like looking at himself. She was 7 years old. "Did she leave?" Violet said slowly. "Or did you make her leave?" William said, carefully. "Miss Sterling made the decision herself." Violet set down her fork. Her face, which had been learning to be open over the past months, learning to show what was inside it, the way Louisa had quietly taught her, went closed. "Door by, door by, door. You always make everyone leave," she said. Not loudly. Not with tears. With the absolute flat certainty of a child who has seen a pattern and named it. She picked up her fork again and ate in silence. And William Ashcroft sat at the head of his table, with something inside him collapsing not dramatically, not all at once, but in the slow, the thorough way of a structure that has lost its load-bearing element and is only now understanding what that element was. He hired another governess. Miss Dawson arrived 2 weeks later, competent, experienced, patient. She set out the lesson books correctly. She maintained appropriate structure. She addressed Violet with professional warmth. Violet sat at her lesson table, with her hands folded precisely in her lap. She did not draw. She did not laugh. She answered every question Miss Dawson asked with minimal, correct responses, and when the lesson was over, she walked to her room and closed the door. Miss Dawson came to William at the end of the first week and said, with visible distress, that she was doing everything correctly, and she could not understand why the child would not engage. William thanked her and said to persist. She lasted 3 weeks. The second governess lasted 2. The third lasted 11 days. The house had been warm. Now it was cold. The servants had been singing. Now they moved through the corridors with the careful quiet of people who know that something has been broken and do not know how to say so. Mrs. Prentice no longer hummed. Beatrice came from her estate in Wiltshire in January, walked through the front door of Silver Oak Hall, stood in the entrance hall, and said, "It smells like a library that has been closed." William did not answer. "You have the look of a man who told himself something untrue," his mother said, "and is only now working out what it cost him." She found him in Eleanor's garden, of all places. He had gone there without meaning to. In the cold of a January morning, standing among the untended roses with his hands behind his back. She said the roses were still growing, he said, without turning around. He knew his mother's footstep, and so they are, Beatrice said. I told her she could be replaced by Dawn. His voice was measured. It was the voice of a man reporting something with terrible precision because he cannot afford to feel it yet. I said it in front of the staff. In front of Charlotte. A long pause. In front of Violet. Beatrice said nothing. I knew it was wrong as I said it, he said. I said it anyway. He turned then, and his face showed what his face almost never showed. The full cost of something. I was frightened. I know, Beatrice said gently. Eleanor and I argued before she died. He had never said this aloud. Not to anyone. The words came out, with the effort of something long buried, being finally brought to air. Our last real conversation ended badly. I was angry about something, something that does not matter now, something that never mattered, and she fell ill that night, and she never recovered well enough to... He stopped. His jaw tightened. I never made it right. Beatrice crossed the garden and stood beside him among the roses. And so you have made yourself a fortress, she said, to ensure that no one can make you feel such loss again. Yes. And Louisa Sterling walked through the walls of that fortress in 3 months. Beatrice's voice was not without sympathy. Without trying. Simply by being what she is. William looked at the roses. At the stems, still reaching along the rusted trellises. Still growing. Where is she? He said. Thornwick Hall, Beatrice said. Lord Prescott has opened a schoolroom for the local children. She is teaching there. She has been there 6 weeks. A pause. I am told she has transformed the place already. William was quiet for a moment. Then he said, She doesn't need me. No, Beatrice agreed. She doesn't. A pause. That is rather the point. He looked at her. Louisa Sterling came to you with nothing and made something beautiful, Beatrice said. She has done it again, without you. She will keep doing it, with or without you, for the rest of her life, because that is simply who she is. She tilted her head. The question is not whether she needs you. The question is whether you are willing to earn her. The word settled between them. Earn, not demand, not employ, not arrange. Earn. William looked at the garden for a long time. Then he went inside and called for his horse. Thornwick Hall was 12 miles north of Silver Oak, a modest estate that had fallen into quiet use as a community school under Lord Prescott's patronage. The building that served as the schoolroom was a converted stone outbuilding, warmed by 2 iron stoves, its windows replaced with new glass, its walls bright with pinned drawings and maps. William rode through the gates on a February morning so cold the puddles were glazed with ice. He heard the schoolroom before he reached it. Not laughter, not quite. But voices. Young voices asking questions, and one voice answering with the kind of attention that makes a child feel like the only person in the room. He stopped his horse at the outbuilding door. Through the window, he could see her. She had her back to him, writing something on a chalk slate. And there were 8 children at the long table behind her, ranging in age from perhaps 5 to 12, some in fine clothes, most in plain ones, and every single one of them was paying attention, leaning forward. Bright-eyed, she turned to answer a question, and her hair was coming down from its pins on one side, and her dress was dusty with chalk at the cuff, and she was smiling with such uncomplicated warmth that it struck him physically, like walking from cold into heat. She looked like herself, fully and completely herself. She had not needed to go back to Silver Oak Hall to become this. She had always been this. He was the one who hadn't been paying attention properly. He dismounted, tied his horse, and waited. She saw him through the window at 1:45. She paused. Her hand, which had been pointing to a word on the slate, stopped. Then she turned back to the class, finished the lesson, dismissed the children for their midday meal, and sent the assistant teacher to oversee them. She walked to the door and opened it. Outside, William Ashcroft stood in the February cold without his hat, which he had removed and was holding at his side. He looked, she noticed, with some complexity of feeling like a man who had not been sleeping well. Miss Sterling, he said. Your Grace. Her voice was composed. She had had 6 weeks to compose herself. May I speak with you? She stepped back and let him inside. The empty schoolroom smelled of chalk and iron stove warmth and old wood. She stood by the window with her arms folded not defensively, but with the self-possession of a woman who had learned to take up appropriate space. He stood near the door, his hat in both hands. I have come to apologize, he said. He said it directly. No preamble, no qualifications. What I said was inexcusable, he said. Not simply the words, though the words were cruel. And I knew they were cruel as I spoke them, but the act of saying it in front of people who cared for you, in front of Violet. He stopped. His jaw worked. I said it from fear. That is not an excuse. It is simply the truth. Louisa looked at him. You told me once, he continued, that Violet needed someone who loved her more than my pride. His voice was quiet. I think I have spent 5 years choosing my pride over everything. Over grief, which needed facing. Over fear, which needed naming. Over. He stopped again. There was something in his face that she had only glimpsed before, briefly, in Eleanor's garden in the rain, the face behind the one he wore. The face of a man who was tired of carrying everything alone. Over you. The schoolroom was very quiet. Violet asks for you, he said. Every day. She has stopped laughing again. A beat. The house has gone cold. Another beat. I have gone cold. Though, in my case, that is perhaps less of a new development. Louisa breathed slowly. What is it that you want, William? She said, quietly. His name in her mouth, the way she'd said it only once before in the library at midnight. He met her eyes. I want to deserve to ask you to come back, he said. I am not certain I do yet. but I am asking anyway, which is either courage or foolishness, and I have rarely known which is which. A pause. I want, Louisa, I want what has been growing in me since the first week you were in that house. I have been fighting it because I was a coward, and because I have been afraid, since Eleanor died, of what it means to need someone again. He looked at her with something in his eyes that was absolutely raw. No wall, no control, just the man himself, standing in a cold schoolroom, asking for something he had no right to expect. I need you, not as a governess, not as staff. I need you the way a house needs its fire. I cannot be warm without you. Louisa stood very still. 6 weeks of rebuilding. 6 weeks of learning to be entirely her own. 6 weeks of getting up each morning and remembering that she was enough without him. All of that remained true. And it was possible for all of that to remain true and still feel this. You hurt me, she said. Yes. You said it in front of your daughter, who loves me. Yes. No excuses. His eyes were steady. And you think that an apology and a declaration constitute repair? No, he said. I think they constitute a beginning. The repair. He stopped. The repair is something I am asking for the chance to do, not in a day, however long it takes. He held her gaze. I am not a man who asks. I have never been a man who asks. I am asking. Louisa looked at him for a long moment. She thought of Violet. Of grey eyes going closed, door by door. She thought of Eleanor's garden. Roses growing on rusted trellises in the cold, reaching for something, still. She thought of his hand, lifted toward her face in the portrait gallery, stopping just before it touched her. She said, I will not be managed. No, he said. You have never allowed it. I would not wish it. I will not be silent when I see something wrong. God forbid you start now. A breath of warmth in that. The faintest edge of something like humor, which she had only ever seen in him in those late-night library moments. She looked at him. I will think on it, she said. He nodded. Put his hat back on. Moved toward the door. He stopped. He turned back. And then William Ashcroft, Duke of Ravenscar, a man who had not asked for anything in 5 years, who had learned at great cost that feelings were safer, sealed, crossed the small space of the schoolroom, and kissed her. Not from passion alone, not from the accumulated want of 4 months, though that was present, God. It was present, warm, and deep, and long. The kind of kiss that is both a question and its answer at once. Not from impulse, from surrender, from the deliberate, terrifying, grateful decision to stop fighting something that had been inevitable since the moment she had stood in the rain at his servant's entrance and refused to bow. She kissed him back. Fully. Finally. With every feeling she had been carefully not having since October, all of it released at once, her hands coming to his lapels because she needed something to hold. They stood together in the warm, chalk, dusty schoolroom for a long moment, his forehead against hers, both of them breathing. Come home, he said, against her hair, very quietly. She closed her eyes. Ask me properly, she said. Later. Later. He agreed. The London ball was in March. It was the Hargrove Spring Gala, one of the first major social events of the season, and every important family in society attended. Charlotte Kensington attended. She was, as always, immaculate, composed, and positioned precisely where she could best be seen. William arrived with Louisa, not as his governess. He had not introduced her as his governess in the weeks since Thornwick Hall. He had introduced her, each time, simply as Miss Sterling with a calm, unadorned certainty that made people read the situation quickly. They were still working toward the formal announcement. There were conversations to be had, arrangements to be made. But Charlotte understood the situation by the time they arrived. She understood it, and she chose to act. Louisa had gone to collect a glass of lemonade when Charlotte appeared at her side, perfectly timed, where 3 other women of the first rank could hear. Miss Sterling. Warm. Delighted. How extraordinary to see you here. In what capacity are you attending this evening? A smile like a blade. Lord Ravenscar's household is fortunate to have such a devoted governess. Tell me, are you always included in such events, or is this a special occasion? The three women nearby went very still. Louisa looked at Charlotte. She thought of the whispers that had gone to London. The letters. The months of quiet destruction. She thought of Violet learning to laugh. Of roses growing on rusted trellises. Of a man standing in a cold schoolroom with his hat in both hands and nothing left to hide behind. She straightened. I am here, she said calmly, as a guest. And then, because the room was watching, and because she was the daughter of an earl and had never once in her life been less than that regardless of what her circumstances had been, she met Charlotte's eyes with complete composure and said nothing further. The silence stretched. And then, across the length of the ballroom, William began walking. Not quickly, not dramatically, with the measured, deliberate pace of a man who has made a decision entirely and is now executing it. He crossed the room. He took Louisa's hand. He turned to face the assembled company. I believe, he said, in a voice that carried without effort, that there may be some confusion as to the nature of Miss Sterling's connection to my household. He did not look at Charlotte. He looked at the room. At the families gathered their friends, acquaintances, people who had known his name and his title and his grief for 5 years. I intend to ask Miss Sterling to be my wife. I expect to be fortunate enough to succeed. A pause. If anyone present believes Lady Louisa Sterling, daughter of the late Earl Sterling, a woman of extraordinary intelligence, character, and grace, to be beneath my consideration, then they may consider themselves beneath my notice. Silence. Complete, utter silence. And then Lord Prescott, standing near the back, began to clap. It was slow at first, deliberate, a single man's applause. Beatrice Ashcroft, who had appeared from somewhere near the orchestra, joined him. Then others, until the room was full of it. Charlotte Kensington stood perfectly still for a moment that was, by any measure, the most uncomfortable of her life. Then she lifted her chin, turned gracefully, and moved away. Louisa looked up at William. His hand was still holding hers, his grip warm and certain. That was perhaps slightly excessive, she said quietly. It was perfectly calibrated, he said. The orchestra began again, and William led her onto the floor, and for the first time at a London ball in many years, he danced. They were married in May, when Eleanor's garden was in bloom. Louisa had asked for that, asked quietly, half expecting him to say it was too much, too close to Eleanor. But he had looked at the garden, at the roses that had come back in full force now, that someone was tending them again, and said, It would be fitting. The ceremony was small. The garden held the household, Beatrice, Lord Prescott, and a handful of people who mattered. Violet stood beside Louisa, in a white dress, and a wreath of white flowers, serving as the most serious flower girl in the history of the institution. She had performed her role with absolute gravity all the way through the garden path, scattering petals with the precision of a military operation. Then, she had taken Louisa's hand. She had not let go for the rest of the ceremony. At the reception, which was held in the garden in the warm May afternoon, Beatrice found William standing slightly apart, watching Louisa, who was seated on the stone bench at the center of the garden, Violet beside her, both of them laughing at something Violet had drawn. Well, Beatrice said, appearing at his shoulder with a glass of champagne she hadn't been given. You've managed not to ruin everything. Thank you, Mother. It is the greatest compliment you have ever given me. Don't get used to them. She sipped her champagne. Look at her. He was already looking. I know, he said. You very nearly didn't, Beatrice said. You came this close to keeping the wall up. She held two fingers a hair's breadth apart. This close. I know, he said again. More quietly. What changed? She asked. Not rhetorical. She actually wanted to know. William was quiet for a moment. The roses, he said. She said they were still growing, even without anyone tending them. That, there was something in that. He watched Louisa lift Violet's drawing and examine it with exaggerated admiration. I had been thinking about that for months before I went to Thornwick. She'd been right. Things that are real keep growing, even in cold, even when you've sealed them away. He paused. She kept growing. I simply had to choose whether to be present for it. Beatrice looked at her son for a long moment. You are, occasionally, almost as intelligent as you believe yourself to be, she said. She kissed his cheek and moved off in search of the cake. 3 years later, Silver Oak Hall was a different place entirely. The servants walked normally now, not carefully, not on eggshells, just normally, the way people walk in a home that is actually a home. The corridors carried sound again. Violet's quick footsteps, the baby's periodic announcements from the nursery upstairs, Beatrice's carrying voice as she made pronouncements from her favorite armchair in the morning room. Eleanor's garden bloomed every spring. Louisa had kept tending it. She had added lavender along the south wall and sweet peas climbing the iron trellises beside the roses. In the summer, the bees were so numerous that Violet had taken to sitting on the stone bench among them and drawing each variety in her sketchbook, which had become enormously detailed and considerably more zoologically accurate than anyone had expected. The small school at Thornwick Hall continued under Louisa's direction. She went there twice a week. William rode with her when his schedule allowed, which it increasingly did, because he had reorganized his schedule specifically to allow it. Nobody mentioned this. On a particular Tuesday in August, William was at his desk when he heard it. He heard it every day now, and every day it settled into him the same way. Like warmth, like fire, like something you had been cold without for so long that you had forgotten what warm meant. Laughter. From the garden below the window. Two voices, Violet's bright one, and another. Smaller, still new, learning the architecture of sound, and then a third. Louisa's, full and unguarded, the way she laughed when she had stopped thinking about how she was presenting herself, and was simply, entirely, there. William rose from his desk. He walked to the window. Below in the garden, his wife was sitting on the stone bench in the summer afternoon, with their 11-month-old daughter in her lap, and Violet beside her. All three of them bent over a book that Violet was reading aloud with great theatrical gusto. The baby kept trying to eat the page, which was causing considerable hilarity. Louisa looked up. Perhaps she heard him, or perhaps she simply felt him. The way she had always had an awareness of him that operated outside of logic and found him at the window. She smiled. Not a polite smile. Not a careful one. The kind that went all the way up. William Ashcroft had once told a room full of witnesses that he could replace her by dawn. He had been wrong about many things in his life. He had never been so thoroughly, so gratefully, so completely wrong about anything. He had not survived a single day without her. He had simply had to be brave enough, finally, to stop trying. And that is where we leave them. William and Louisa. The Duke who thought he could replace her by dawn and never recovered from the moment she let him try. If this story moved you, hit that like button, subscribe, and share this with someone who loves a good slow burn. And drop a comment right now, tell me where in the world you are watching from. I read every single one. Until next time, thank you for staying until the end. That is always where the best people are.